Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada, as we turn our attention to Yahweh and his Torah teaching, his Torah guidance regarding his covenant, his bereth, his one and only family-oriented relationship. We have Kirk back on the line calling in from California. Kirk was with us a couple of days last week and had a host of good questions. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hello, how are you doing? Good morning.
Howdy.
I had a question about the nature of Yahusha, but before I did, just relating to what you were just discussing, I've seen the first edition King Iams Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's and it doesn't say James, it says Iams, and therefore there wouldn't be anything in that it says Jesus.
Mm-mm.
And therefore, if it's inerrant, then what happens?
Yeah, what happened?
Yeah,
yeah, that's what the old line is, of course, that Christians will hold up their Bible and they'll claim it's inerrant. It's just utterly thoughtless because they're reading a translation and no two translations are even remotely the same. I mean, there's huge differences between the translations, and you brought up this one. This was, it's a first edition. It has Isu as the Christian God. But beyond that, there aren't two manuscripts that are the same. You know, the Textus Receptus, which was originally the basis for the earliest English translations. Actually, they were translated out of Latin into to English, but they claimed that at least they were based on the Textus Receptus. That was a complete and utter fraud. And the Textus Receptus was designed to be a money-making scheme. And yet Protestant Christianity talks about it being the text received directly from God. And when there were huge sections, and it was a medieval manuscript that they were using to create it, a 12th century manuscript, and it was a highly flawed manuscript at that. And when there were sections that the manuscript didn't have, like, for example, that whole John 8, Yahochanan 8 discussion of the woman who had committed adultery, he without sin cast the first stone. Of course, it didn't have that, and so they went to the Latin and wrote it in. And when the Roman Catholic Church wouldn't accept it, they said, well, what is it you don't like? What's missing here? And they said, well, you know, it doesn't have this, that, and the other thing. And so the authors said, well, you give us some basis for it, and we'll put it right in. So the Roman Catholic Church translated the Latin that they liked into Greek and handed them the Greek translation of the Latin and said, here you go. Okay, that works for me. And what people don't recognize is that we do have now some 69 first, second, third, and early fourth century manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament. And those earlier manuscripts differ from the basis of Christian translations today of the Greek manuscript in over 300,000 places. There's only 180-some-odd thousand words. And yet there are 300,000 discrepancies between these various manuscripts, and particularly between the older ones and what Christians find written in their Bibles. And so this notion of inerrancy is so laughable, is to be just one of the greatest jokes perpetrated in the name of religion. So, yeah, you and I are on the same page there.
Well, even the guy in Oxford said, you know, when Menace of King James was published, he came out with, 30,000 errors.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they
from his handful of Greek documents.
This was after the King James was published, and I've forgotten his name right off the top of my head, but he was trying to deal with the obviously erroneous nature of the statement that regarding the day he's going to return, that it's known only the Father, Son doesn't even know. And he was, correctly said, wait a minute, at least the translation we have is written in Greek, and it's written in the present tense, and all it says is you fellows don't know. But he found over 20,000 discrepancies between the various manuscripts that he had from that period of time and what was used in the Textus Receptus. So he says, this claim of it being inerrant is absurd. And, of course, he was drummed out for being a heretic because one thing belief systems can't handle, they can't process the truth. So you are correct.
Well, I'm going to get to my question, but just as a little aside, if Yahushua wanted the church, right, he didn't leave any instructions on how to put it together, or officers, how it would work. I mean, why wouldn't he if that's what he wanted?
Well, yeah, in effect, he didn't say anything remotely akin to church.
Close to that word, but I mean,
Well, not only didn't he say church, which is the name of a pagan sun goddess, church, he didn't even say ecclesia. You know, he didn't speak Greek. Yeah, he spoke. He spoke in Hebrew, and he said mikra. And so he has a mikra, man. He paid a dear price to enable the promises of the mikra because he was the Passover lamb, because he was the sacrificial ransoming soul that went to Sheol in our stead on matzah. So, man, he had a up close and personal experience with the mikra, he knew that it was essential that his life be considered, be viewed as establishing these. And that's why, when Shimon Kefesh proclaimed that recognized him as the work of Yah, as the Masiyah, that he said, upon this rock I will build my mikra. I'm going to establish my mikra because that is what Masiyah means. It's the work of Yah and the process of saving us. So it is it's a real catastrophe for Christians that their religious institutions have deliberately and purposefully, knowingly misled them in such egregious ways.
Well, that kind of leads into segues into my question on the nature of Yahushua.
Yes.
Now, when I'm gonna set it up just a little bit. When Yahweh visited the first five times prior to 33 of the common era.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that's a group of times,
right.
Spent a lot of time with Adam and Shaul, and that could have been up to 70 years.
He met with Abraham seven times. He met with Abraham seven times.
Yeah.
So, you're right.
We say there's five different times.
Periods,
times when he came by. And,
right. Because we have no idea how much time he spent with Adam in the garden, and it would be irrelevant anyway, because at the moment that he was visiting with Adam, time didn't matter. They're both immortal.
Yes. So, and Jacob and Samuel and so forth.
Right.
But prior to prior to the 33 CE time, is he Yahweh as a diminished form, or is he Yahusha?
I think that any time God takes on human form, he would refer to himself as Yahusha in a corporeal form. But what your question really becomes unanswerable. It's a question that it implies that there is a difference when there really is no difference.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Yahusha is not a unique individual. It's not a unique name. In fact, Yahusha, while it does serve as a name, it's far more important to look at Yahusha as an identity designation and a mission statement. Since Yahusha is Yahweh saving us, then Yahusha, to use Yahusha versus Yahweh is in many ways actually misleading.
Yes.
Because it's still Yahweh. Yahusha isn't all of Yahweh. But it's as much of Yahweh as can be represented materially. Yeah. So it gets really into the issue of, for example, on the seventh visit, which will be in year 6000 Yah 2033 in our pagan calendars, when he comes back on the Day of Reconciliations. Everything indicates that he's coming back as Yahweh. And so when he says that he's going to return, and this is Yahusha speaking and saying, I'm going to return, he's really answering this question, I think, which is that even though he's returning and not as Yahusha, as Yahweh, isn't Yahusha simply Yahweh? And I think that the reason that the distinction is made so clearly that when he returns, he is Yahweh, is that while he still has to be somewhat diminished, he's still coming back brighter than the light of constellations.
Yes. Well, then, is there some separation at all when a child's born and the son's given?
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a body with great mm-hmm. DNA,
mm-hmm.
obviously of this child, and mm-hmm. it also has a nephesh, a mm-hmm. soma rather, as well as a nephesh soul.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now, and then when the soul, you go through Pesach, and then you go through Matzah,
mm-hmm.
and then on Bikurim, the set-apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh, takes him out of Sheol, mm-hmm. and he returns to Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, this is, it doesn't really matter that much to me, but I'm just kind of confused. There's this soul that's now part of Yahweh.
Yeah, see, what's interesting here is that the soul that Yahusha deployed is Yahweh's. Yahweh twice
right.
speaks of having a soul. And Yahweh, who is spirit, would only have a soul for a specific purpose, and that purpose was to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, and particularly Matzah. And so the question is, when does that soul cease to be Yahusha's and become Yahweh's, and cease to be Yahweh's and become Yahusha's, and when does Yahweh become Yahusha, and when does Yahusha then become Yahweh?
That's
and,
a good question.
Yeah, and I think that the answer is there is a time before there was a Yahusha, because there was a time before there could be a corporeal manifestation.
Before matter, he wouldn't need to be.
Right, that is correct. So before God transitions some of his energy into the material universe, there could not have been a manifestation of him that is material. So there could have been no Yahusha in a sense of a material presentation. And as we go forward into time, I suspect there will be times when Yahweh, just as we, even though we will be spiritual beings, will want to take on corporeal form. We want to express ourselves materially so that we can enjoy food, song, so we can enjoy a moment in time in a new world. We'll be back with Kirk after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk, who's called in from California, regarding the distinction between Yahweh and Yahusha. And Kirk, I think there's only one distinction between Yahusha and Yahweh that matters. And that is that Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, that Yahusha is part of Yahweh, but not all of Yahweh. And so long as we recognize what a diminished manifestation that is set apart represents, then the only distinction that matters is that when you consider Yahusha, you recognize that is a diminished aspect of Yahweh. And so, would you, recognizing that, we know that that's not the entirety of Yahweh, but that is a glimpse of what Yahweh is like, that has some merit, but only merit, when using Yahusha as a lens to better understand Yahweh.
Well, I was not asking in the sense that that he needs to be focused on or.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond what he did, right. is from that thing. It's just when you have a conversation with somebody,
Christian
background as well. So I mean, it's just when someone asks you a question or something regarding it, it's nice to just trying to get kind of clear in my mind.
I think that the formula E equals MC squared actually explains it. Which is that, Yahweh, who is energy, can equate to, be equated to matter, but only in a radically, stunningly diminished form. And so, I also struggle with this from time to time. I've gotten kind of in a habit that I'm much more comfortable with, which, I'd prefer to err on the side of Yahweh and to recognize that Yahusha is less a name than it is an identity designation and a mission statement. So I think so long as you know that it's Yahweh who is saving us, and that's what Yahusha means, and that it is Yahweh himself that is representing part of himself through Yahusha, then it's hard to go wrong. And beyond that, Kirk, the only other thing that
you
I would say...
You don't need to know everything. I mean...
Well, yeah, but beyond that, you want to err, on the side of Yahweh. That's what Yahusha told us. But the moment we become fixated or focused on Yahusha, I think we're misdirected. Yeah, we're misdirected. Yahusha didn't want that either. He wanted us to focus on the Father, on Yahweh.
He says it all the time.
Yeah, he does. And so that's the problem of Christianity. They have turned their God into a man. The man represents the totality of their God. And it's an incredibly dangerous position to be in and completely counter to Yahusha's own position. You know, even in the statement where Yahweh says, do you know my name? Do you know my son's name? Once you know the name, you know that the son is part of Yahweh. It's a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. And therefore, it's God himself, the one and only God, who has but one name that is in the business of saving his children.
Now, how did they get away with using so many Yah words? If you couldn't use Yah in the 33 era,
how did
they get away with using so many Yah words and names, but they couldn't say Yahweh?
They didn't, actually. The whole Shoah, they call it now Sheba, but it's based upon the Hebrew word Shoah, which means to corrupt. That whole system was specifically designed to change the pronunciation of the three letters that are in Yahweh's name. And so they did not say Yah, they said Yeh. So they changed Yah to Yeh. And then they began to vocalize the O, which is the W in Hebrew, as the vowel O, as a V. And so what you end up with is a corruption, so that first of all, Yahweh would never be said, but the prophets like they'll say Yasha, but it'd be Yasha-eh. You know, they're going to do everything they can to avoid saying Yahweh or Yao or any portion of his name. And yet the problem with that, of course, is that all of the other Hebrew words that are pronounced that have the same letters in it, you know, if you can pronounce Torah, you can pronounce Yahweh. I mean, there is the only letter that's not in Yahweh or in Torah that's not in Yahweh is the Y, which is the most direct, the easiest, the least controversial to pronounce. It's not hard. You don't have to be a genius to be able to pronounce Yahweh. Welcome back to Shatteringness. It is astonishingly odd that Christianity can be based on a New Testament, on a new covenant. When Yahweh says this to us in his Torah regarding his covenant, he says this one and only Zeth, family-oriented covenant relationship of mine, Bereth, which is relationally you should continually and always observe. Well, not for a short period of time, but always. Between me, so that you might understand me, and between you, so that you might understand our relationship, and between your offspring following you, you should actually circumcise Mul. Accordingly, your every male child, for them to remember. So how is it that Christianity can be based on the letters of Paul, who denounced vehemently, viciously, circumcision? How can they be based on the letters of Paul, who proposed the notion that there was a second and different covenant, and that the one spoken of here enslaved? Wouldn't you have to be either completely ignorant of what God said, or completely irrational, therefore, to be a Christian? And if that's so, how could there be 2.5 million, 2.5 billion Christians?
A lot of us stupid people around.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily think that they're stupid, but they certainly are.
Trust,
you know,
trust the wrong people.
Right, ignorant and irrational apply. Ignorant means that it's impossible for them to know what Yahweh said and be a Christian unless they are irrational. So they're either ignorant, irrational, or both.
And now, you twist all the scriptures or all the God's word around to the point that you almost have to have an interpreter to figure out what it's talking about. And then you do it in Old English, which is like reading Beowulf. You know, when you go...
Oh, that sounds religious, though, when you have the these and the thous and the shans and the shalls. Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And this is what Yahweh said next. And you shall cut off and separate, mul, you should circumcise your foreskin in association with the flesh. And this will exist as the sign to remember, oath, as the example to visually illustrate and explain the family-oriented covenant relationship between me to encourage understanding and between you so that you understand. You know, it's pretty straight, definitive statement. Right, yeah. If you want to participate in this covenant as parents, circumcise your sons. It says, no, you don't have to circumcise your sons. God did not say here, you either circumcise your sons or I'm going to torture you in hell. Doesn't say that. God didn't say you either circumcise your sons or I'm going to really see to it that your life is miserable. He didn't say that.
No.
It's not an order. God says, but if you want to participate in this covenant, then you need to show your sign, your signature, your commitment to the covenant. And that's going to be circumcising your sons. Now, you only have to do this if you want to participate in the covenant. And what God is saying, I mean, this is addressed to parents. It's not addressed to us, although he will twice tell us that if we're male and not circumcised, then we ought not participate in Passover, which means we're going to remain mortal. And we ought not to think for a moment that we're going to be allowed into heaven, because he's really clear on those two points. But this is instruction, Kirk, is for parents. And what God is saying is because the covenant is a family-oriented relationship, if you want to participate, if you want to be included into my family, then I expect you to deal with your family in a similar fashion. I want you to show the same degree of concern for the truth being shared with your children as I have for the truth being shared with you. Right. And that's really what he's saying here. You know, this is my eternal family. I'm going to spend all time with these individuals. And you know, I want individuals that are part of my family who are as family-oriented as I am. That's what God is saying. You don't have to be family-oriented. You don't have to do the right thing for your children. You can poison them with religion. It's just that you can't be part of God's family. If you do, you know, God's trying to cull the herd. You know, there's a pretty unruly herd out there. You know, that's why there's so much death and destruction being attributed to religion. That's why there's so much carnage and misinformation that is hurtful and harmful out there, is because through religion and politics and the media and through military, we've really made a mess of this world. And God's just saying, you know, I don't want the same rubbish and deadly disease in my home. So, forever. I'm going to restrict who participates in my home, and I'm going to do it in the fairest way possible. I'm going to give you, these are the conditions that will create an enjoyable eternity. If you agree with them, you are welcome.
They're not horrible conditions. Well, not really. Come on.
But he's going to say these are the eternal conditions that I'm going to establish to participate in my covenant. If you agree with them, you are welcome. If you don't agree with them, you're not welcome, because you're not going to ruin it for the rest of us. And And, you know, as I look at those conditions, there's not a single one of those conditions that's not a benefit. Now, I'm going to tell you, the first one's tough, but it's a benefit. Well, the first one is by far the hardest.
It's fun to be free of it. It's fun to be free of it once you get away from it all.
Yeah, what Kirk is talking about is the fact that the first condition to participate in a covenant is disassociating yourself from your country, from government, from religious institutions, from the prevalence of militarism as a solution. It's God's really clear. Walk away from Babylon. And Babylon, he explains in the entirety of the revelation through Jeremiah, is religion and politics. And Yoshe himself, by the way, affirmed this when, you know, his disciples were sailing across the Galilee, and he spoke of bread. They say, "Oh boy, we didn't bring any bread, and oh boy, aren't we stupid?" And he said, "Oh, come on now, don't you remember the instruction on the mount? If I was interested in you bringing bread, don't you think I could just make bread?"
Now, I did that once before.
Yeah, I did that once before. You know, aren't you following along? He says, "I wanted to speak to you about yeast. Do you understand what the yeast that comes out of the bread on the matzah represents?" And he says explicitly, it's religion and politics. That's what it is. That's what's being removed from you. And so that's the hardest of all, is for us to walk away from religion and politics, because patriotism and the celebration of military and the like is such a pervasive part of our society. And for those who come to realize that you can't be religious and consider the words of God. If you're really interested in what God had to say, you will cease being religious. You know, family members have a tough time with that because their whole world is structured by their religious misconceptions. And so walking away from religion and politics is tough for people. But once you've done it, once you realize, wow, you know, I confess, I was a right-wing Republican who looked at the church committee's investigation into the FBI as this horrible affront to American patriotism and pride, and come to find out, yeah, it was a beneficial thing. Should have gone further. So we have to recognize that what we have adhered to was actually counterproductive. And letting go is liberating. It's freeing. I'm going to tell you, it's much better from this perspective of where you can look at the ills of government and of politics and of religion and say, "Oh boy, my God, I'm not part of that anymore."
Yeah, you have to observe it. I mean, it's there. It's part of the world we live in, but you don't have to be part of it, no.
Yeah, if, you know, God didn't call us out of the world in the sense of leaving the planet. And if you look at his example, which is a pretty good one to follow, you know, he was very keenly aware of the religious and political corruptions that have permeated our world over time. And he denounced them. And so if we're going to follow the same example, you're right, Kirk, we need to be aware of what's wrong in government, what's wrong in militarism, what's wrong in economic schemes, what's wrong in religion, and denounce it just as he did.
I don't want to wear out my welcome, but can I ask another quick question?
Oh, sure. No, you're welcome with everyone out.
Well, Yossi, 17 and 18. Now, I know you've been talking about that a little bit. I don't care whether it's mostly on Friday evening or whether during the thing, but there's a sequence of events that I was just curious about one thing. Mm-hmm. You have Damascus falls and it's wasted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we have Israel being squeezed at the waist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Magog War would begin, correct?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was putting the pieces together again this morning because I worked on it all during this weekend. And what I promised to do was to make Isaiah 17. Yeah, it's a good gun to jump. I promised to make it a significant part of this program going forward. Because I've taken a lot of time over these last few weeks to translate Isaiah 17 and 18. And I've learned a lot in so doing. In fact, let me kind of summarize where I think where we are at this point. Yahweh said that the triggering mechanism for the final wars that will devastate humankind is going to be the fall of Damascus. And he specifically says that Damascus itself will be a heap of ruins. Now, it's getting there. It's not now. Right. Pretty close, but it's not there now. And he specifically says that the Syrian government's going to, the government out of Damascus and Syria itself is going to fall. So that answers one of the questions I said previously. I didn't really know what God's position would be, whether or not the Sunnis or the Shias were ultimately going to prevail. God tells us. The Sunni jihadists are going to prevail over the Assad regime. So we do know who is going to win that war. But the consequence, according to God, is that not only is Damascus destroyed, a heap of ruins, and is the government out of Damascus no longer exist, and greater Syria fall, but the onslaught is going to be so savage that the terrorists will have no one left to terrorize. Welcome back to Shattering Mercy. We have Kirk with us, and who has been discussing a whole series of very pertinent comments, and we were in the midst of going through the timing and the issues pertaining to this end times prophecy that begins with the destruction of Damascus. And before we get to Cherie, who is called in from Texas, Kirk, I do want to kind of go through the timeline here. First is the fall of Damascus, which we are witnessing, but it is not concluded at this point. We are told that the Syrian government is going to fail and that the government out of Damascus will cease to exist, which means that the Sunni jihadists prevail. We are then told that the terrorism that they perpetrate on one another is so severe, they finally get to the point where there's no one left to terrorize. Immediately we transition to the world capitulates on Israel and forces Israel to give up the West Bank, which makes, according to Yahweh, Israel unsustainable as a nation. It becomes so vulnerable because the thinning at the waist reduces Israel to about 10 to 15 miles wide, where 70% of its population lives, with these Muslims and their militaries now in a pincer effect of that kind. You know what it's going to lead to. It's going to be the same thing as the catalyst for World War II with Neville Chamberlain and sacrificing Czechoslovakia. Now, what we're told immediately thereafter is we're told about a gleaning. And the gleaning is a secondary harvest. The primary harvest occurred on on Bukhara in 33 CE, and we're told that there's going to be a gleaning, and that it's going to be the secondary, smaller harvest is going to be very small. And so in conjunction with the thinning of Israel is when the Teruah harvest of covenant children is going to take place. And that
you don't want to miss.
It's something you do not want to miss, because the time after it is literally hell on earth. And it's even specified is that there's going to be two or three from the top limbs of the olive, and then four or five from a limb which has been separated, cut off. And I think what if you look at the low number and the high number, you have seven, which is Yah's favorite number. And I think what he's talking about is that from Yisrael, from the choicest limbs of the olive, you're going to have a couple of thousand people that'll be harvested. And from the Goyim who are adopted into the covenant, who are cut off from being direct descendants of Jacob, there's going to be about 5,000. And it could be as much as 3,000 and 4,000, that's how many people, 7,000 people collectively, that are going to make that harvest. God then tells us the nature of those who make the harvest, which is they are completely anti-religious. And he goes through a depiction of the religious nonsense that will not be anywhere to be seen going forward. So it's a clean separation from religion going forward. He specifically mentions Asherah, which is the basis of Christianity and Easter and the and Mary, the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God. This then transitions to a God's telling his own people that, you know, you've rejected me. And because you rejected me, what's going to befall you is going to happen because I'm not intervening to stop the onslaught initially, although he does intervene eventually. And and we hear then of terrible devastation that's going to take place. It's, he uses terms as tidal waves and a flood of nations that come against Israel. And this and Israel is now in a position where they can't stop this tidal wave that will come against it. It cannot stop this flood of marauding terrorists and militaries that come against it. But God finally says that his spirit will blow them away. But he says that his spirit is going to blow them away prior to the approaching storm, which means that, all right, he has stopped the Islamic invasion of Israel. And after they've done horrendous devastation and destruction, he has blown the Muslims away. Are no more Muslims. But he says he's done so before the approaching storm. I think the approaching storm is the second phase of that war. And he transitions immediately to a depiction of the United States and uses some 30 different descriptive terms to designate the United States. You know, we've run out of time here for today, and Cherie, I wanted to be able to answer your question on circumcision. Would you be so kind as to call back at this time tomorrow, maybe a little earlier in the program, and I promise I'll get to it, and I apologize for not answering it today. Kirk, thank you for calling and for your focus on this unbelievably important prophecy.